Welcome to All Sides with Dan Fisher. He referred to Tea Party members as racist and xenophobic and said that federal funding for NPR wasn't needed. And Ron Schiller, now former NPR fundraiser, was recorded saying all that and more. The recording was made public this week, and in its wake, NPR CEO Vivian Schiller has resigned. Today, we continue to explore the backstory of this and other NPR troubles with NPR Ombudsman Alicia Shepard. Welcome to the show, Alicia.
Thank you. Wish I weren't back here talking about something that ultimately could hurt public radio.
You're supposed to wrap up your term as ombudsman in May, and I was thinking, boy, they're definitely getting their money's worth out of you this last 6 months.
Well, I will hope it's not they, but that the listeners and the public radio stations, for which my job is to be their advocate and to represent their concerns. And I think I think the stations are concerned, and I think the listeners are concerned, and not necessarily. I mean, NPR is a good news organization, but as we both know, public broadcasting is in the fight of its life to continue to receive federal funding.
You know, let me put a positive spin on all of this.
Please.
You must see people. This has given you an opportunity when so much public interest is fixated on this, a great opportunity to explain how NPR operates, how public media operates.
Yes, that is definitely true. But the target still seems to be NPR, as though NPR represents all public media or public radio. And clearly, if you listen to WOSU, your show is on. That's not produced by NPR. Car Talk is distributed by NPR, but it isn't produced by NPR. There's just a lot on public radio that Marketplace, which is American public media. I mean, every station is run independently and makes a decision about what programming they want to buy. And among the programs that they buy are All Things Considered and Morning Edition and Talk of the Nation and Tell Me More. And those are the only four shows that are actually produced by NPR.
We have an email from John, and I wanted to read it because it brings up the whole issue about understanding how NPR operates financially. He says that he switches around between Bob Connors on 610 a.m., Oldies on 920 a.m., Sports Talk on 1460 a.m., and your station. I like all four of you, but I don't feel any obligation to send your station any money during fundraisers because nobody else asks that. I'd prefer you went private and had ads. I've learned to tune those commercials out, and the ads on radio are a chance to take my trash out to the curb or start my dishwasher. It's harder to tune out the fundraisers. Those are really annoying, and I'm not sure you have fewer ads than the commercial stations, but you just have all yours at once. NPR has lots of quality programming, and I wouldn't stop listening to the shows, but I'd prefer you be a for-profit station and pay taxes as opposed to being subsidized by taxpayer money. Now, number one, there's a lot of time to take out the garbage when I'm doing my pitches during fundraising time. But beyond that, I mean, the idea of NPR being going commercial, is it an either-or situation?
I don't think that, NPR and PBS and the public radio stations fall under the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, which has a national mandate to serve and educate the public. And so it's a very different mandate than a for-profit that's interested in making money. So I don't see that happening. I think possibly in the long run, maybe there could be a gradual weaning off of the federal government largesse and be able to fund the stations and fund NPR on corporate sponsorship, philanthropy, and foundations and investments. But definitely no one is there at this point, and that it would be terrible to just suddenly, it would be like, cutting off the lifeline for, there are over 100 stations for whom they would go dark if they didn't get federal funding.
Across
the country. Mm-hmm. And they're in rural areas and in places where that is the only news source. You know, the gentleman who emailed in, he's got a lot of choices, and he's very fortunate. And I think that any good news consumer will get news from various sources and not just one.
Let's go to the, by the way, my guest is Alicia Shepherd. She's the NPR ombudsman. If you have a question or comment for Alicia, you know, you're welcome to give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So let's get to the issue at hand. Ron Schiller, former NPR fundraiser. What is the role of an NPR fundraiser? What was he doing when he was being video recorded talking?
He had gotten a phone call, I imagine, from a group that was presenting themselves as a Muslim philanthropy group and offering NPR $5 million. And this group was allegedly connected to the Muslim Brotherhood, which is certainly in the news now with everything that's happening in Egypt mm-hmm. and the rest of the Middle East. And so the chief fundraiser is somebody who tries to get big corporate and institutional money for NPR and for the stations. I mean, they were working in partnership. And as I wrote in a column that I just posted yesterday, Ron Schiller came to NPR having worked at the University of Chicago, raised a lot of money there. He came with very high expectations and saying that public radio was leaving a lot of money on the table, that at the pledge drives, you're asking for $20, $100, and he said they should be working with donors, large institutional organizations, philanthropies, and asking for millions. And so that was very exciting to the possibilities of public radio getting that kind of money. So anyway, he did have lunch with this group, he and another person in his department, and there were statements made, as you said, about his attitude, very disparaging attitude towards conservatives, towards the Tea Party, accusations about Jewish liberals controlling the media, and saying that NPR would be fine without federal funding. And I think if there's a lesson in all of this, Anne, if you pull back, we live in a world now where you have to assume that the mic is always on, that anything you do and say in public will be used against you. Now, that's a defensive posture. But as I've said several times, it just still blows my mind that someone would share so much of how they personally feel, and even if they say, I'm taking off my NPR hat, but share so much mm-hmm. with a complete stranger, mm-hmm. someone you are just meeting for the first time. And secondly, why wouldn't NPR have carefully vetted a potential donor before they even met with them?
PBS did.
Apparently they did not, and I'm sorry that I was on Diane Rehm's show yesterday, and Patrick Butler, who represents public television, said that, I later found out he had heard secondhand, but the New York Times reported, having talked to PBS, that PBS met with the fund, with this Muslim front group, and immediately, did have lunch with them, but just said, he just got the vibe that there was something off, and apparently he must not have said anything worth putting on a video, or James O'Keefe, this conservative political activist, would have used that.
James O'Keefe, activist, he calls himself a citizen journalist. Mm-hmm. If ever there was an indication that NPR and other organizations like it, you get that sense of the target on your back, if nothing else.
Well, that's the third thing. When I look back at how Ron Schiller behaved, I think during Watergate, a colleague told me that Katharine Graham, who was the editor or the publisher of the Washington Post, which was doing all this out front reporting that everyone was suspicious of, and the Nixon administration just was totally vehemently opposed to, she warned the staff, we are going to be a target. Watch yourself. And considering the highly charged political environment that Washington and maybe outside of Washington, lives in, you have to be thinking about that all the time.
614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. And JR from Columbus, you're on the air with Alicia Shepherd. Welcome to the show.
Yes, thanks for taking my call. The concern that I have is really twofold. There has been a propensity, and the argument can be made, that the growth of the modern conservative movement really grew out of talk radio. And there is still a huge power in the media, even in the Internet age. Mm-hmm. Would NPR be better off, post-Citizens United, recognizing that they could be a very powerful source of news and information for the progressive left and for the labor unions? And maybe they're better off losing their funding in order to free them to provide news without the onus of trying to represent the other side, which oftentimes presents less than truthful information about themselves. The infrastructure is in place. I used to work for an NPR station some time ago. And with the equipment costs underfoot, yes, this is something that needs to be upgraded from time to time. But this could become a very powerful vehicle for the progressive left at a time when opportunities to contribute by corporations that hold political agendas that do not necessarily coincide with the beliefs of Republican governors across the northern part of the country. Should NPR reinvent itself as something and unburden themselves from the current funding situation that they have?
I think where to begin, but I would say that the mission of public radio is not to represent one side or the other. And I know you're saying we'll get private funding, but it just seems to me that and this is my personal feeling, that, you know, where we fall down as a society is that we aren't open to new ideas and to listening to other people's ideas, and that particularly that don't agree with us, and that would only encourage more polarization. And NPR's mission is, core values of public radio go against what you're talking about, which would be, you know, credibility, respect for the listener. I'm looking at them right now, you know, curiosity, substance, education, and I really don't see that happening.
Thank you, JR. 614-292-8513. If you have a question or comment for our guest, Alicia Shepard, she's the NPR ombudsman. She leaves that post in May. So we have her for a few more months, and we appreciate her time today. If you want to give us a call, you can also email us at allsides@wosu.org, or you can go to Facebook, All Sides with Dan Fisher Facebook page. We'll be right back. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.
This is 89.7 NPR News, and you can get caught up with local and national news Friday nights on WOSU-TV. Join us this week at 10 p.m. for Washington Week, followed by local news with Columbus on the Record at 10:30. And then watch the McLaughlin Group at 11. Spend your Friday night with WOSU-TV. That's tomorrow night, beginning at 10.
Support for WOSU 89.7 comes from the Women's Fund of Central Ohio, presenting Goldie Hawn for the 2011 Keyholder event on May 11th at the Ohio Theater. Tickets and more information online at womensfundcentralohio.org.
39 degrees in downtown Columbus. Temperatures falling throughout the day today with occasional rain showers. And then a rain-snow mix this evening, becoming all snow overnight. 1 to 2 inches of accumulation are possible, and a low of 28 degrees. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Alicia Shepard. She is the ombudsman for NPR. If you have a question or comment for her, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Of course, we're talking about the latest scandal with NPR. One of its senior vice president for fundraising, Ron Schiller, has criticized the Tea Party and said that NPR would be better off without federal funding. He did so during a conversation with some bogus funders sponsored by the self-proclaimed citizen journalist James O'Keefe. If you recall, James O'Keefe is the same fellow who videotaped at the Acorn offices, and there was another. Was it Planned Parenthood recently?
Well, he was not involved in the Planned Parenthood, but last night I appeared on CNN Piers Morgan, and I was really glad that Piers brought up the issue of, you know, is this kind of journalism, quote unquote, fair to edit, you know, to do these hidden camera stings on people. And Andrew Breitbart, who represented the conservative point of view, because he has been involved in, as you mentioned, Planned Parenthood, and also he was the one who put the Shirley Sherrod video and made that public. That was the African-American woman who worked for USDA, who was misquoted as saying she didn't want to help white farmers, and then the rest of the video showed the story. So when I first heard about the Ron Schiller video, the first thing I did, the very first thing, was contact Ron Schiller and say, is this true? And I, you know, encouraged NPR to do the same, and I'm sure that they did. We operate differently in that I am independent of NPR. But he said that, yes, it had been heavily edited. It's 2 hours, but that he had said those same things. So, you know, I think there's room for, you know, that kind of hidden camera, as Andrew Breitbart pointed out. NBC does that with the To Catch a Predator, but it's the being fair and being, when you selectively edit to make a point, then it becomes political, and it's very unfortunate that Ron Schiller got caught up in it, that he didn't have the good judgment, you know, to not voice his, you know, total what he feels. But it's also really unfortunate, and I just have to say this, there are 900 public radio stations. There's NPR has a staff of about 800. You know, that is the heart and soul of public radio and that kind of journalism. And, you know, it will go on. They will continue to do the kind of reporting. You will continue to do your show. And, you know, it's a distraction, and it's really unfortunate that so much the poor judgment has been shown at the top management of NPR. But NPR is not totally public radio. It's a part of public radio.
You did a Q&A with readers at the Washington Post yesterday, and one of the questions caught my eye. They asked, will NPR offer some sort of platform to the Tea Party, or at least more favorable coverage, to demonstrate that Ron Schiller's comments truly don't reflect the organization's belief? What about that idea that the reporting would change or the coverage would change?
I hope that it wouldn't, in the sense that I hope that they are already doing that and already offering the Tea Party opportunities to be quoted. And, you know, you have to be careful. You would hope that NPR would not suddenly feel, when I say that, the journalist here would not suddenly feel that, oh, we have to be careful. We have to, you know, just give a voice to the Tea Party. No, that's journalists should be covering what's going on and giving a voice to everyone, and it seems everyone who matters in this in a particular debate. And people say, "Oh, NPR has too many liberal Democrats on or something." And I thought, well, you know, should the NPR ombudsman count up the number of Republicans, count up the number of Democrats in a random month? And how accurate would that reflect the news? It wouldn't. Right now, I think there are probably more Republicans on NPR because the House controls Congress, and I'm talking about in terms of politics, and they're making the news. The Senate isn't making the news. What's going on in the House of Representatives because of a new leadership is making the news. And that's how you cover things, not trying to give a voice to one side that feels it's being slighted.
Ahmed from Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for letting me come on there. I really, really, you know, I can't describe how much we appreciate NPR. And there's nothing else out there. There's so many commercial stations out there, but you go through the dial and there's no intelligent life forms out there. Okay. And for the government to cut down the little funding that NPR gets on, I know it's really not much. You know, I think it's really an attack on any kind of intelligent radio in this country. And, you know, all we can do is try to call our congressmen, try to call our Senate, and see what we can do to help to remedy this situation. That's really all that I have to say.
Okay. Thank you, Ahmed.
You know, this is not new in the history of public radio that it is being, or public broadcasting, that it's being threatened with having its money cut off. It's come up a few times in the past. You know, what's different about this, and isn't necessarily political, is a looming $1.6 trillion deficit. I, of course, you know, would prefer that public radio continue to get funding because I think it does serve a good, useful purpose for, you know, the rest of the country. But, you know, you say, well, there are lots of little programs that get only $400 million, only $500 million, and, you know, it all adds up. And so I just think it is important to realize that the deficit is really what is threatening public radio.
Let's talk about why Vivian Schiller went down with the vote this time. What happened and why was she involved?
Vivian Schiller was the CEO up until yesterday of NPR and is no relation to Ron Schiller.
Right.
And she has headed NPR for the last 2 years, and I believe the board of directors, again, it's important to point out that I don't speak for NPR. I really am the listener representative, but I did speak with the chairman of the NPR board, and they made a decision that, you know, there's been a series of unfortunate, call them what you will, incidents in the last 6 months that have become distractions, and that they felt that it was no longer possible for Vivian, who has been at the top during this period, to effectively lead NPR and represent NPR.
614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. My guest is Alicia Shepherd. She's the ombudsman for NPR. And Karen from Bexley, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
I just kind of wanted to reiterate what the last caller said, that so much of what NPR does is not political at all. And I listen to NPR because I feel like cover stories that don't get covered in mainstream media and that are interesting and thoughtful. And it would be such a shame to lose that. And I think any kind of privatization would do that. That being said, I have to say, as a very loyal 20-year listener, I am so disappointed that someone who works for NPR would, forget the fact that he was, you know, set up or whatever, would say such things, and really saddened by it.
Me too, Karen.
And I'm sure, is that the general feeling at the organization? Like, you say you're apart from it, but I mean, I would imagine that this is just a terrible blow to morale there.
Absolutely. In fact, I just wrote a column yesterday, and I was just looking for John Burnett, who has been here for 25 years as a journalist and is based in Austin, said, you know, this is sickening to the reporters. I've given 25 years of my professional life to NPR, and I've tried to be careful when I speak in public or speak to people I don't know. And now for Ron Schiller to carelessly bring this on our company at this super sensitive time is enraging. And Susan Stamberg was equally passionate yesterday, speaking on All Things Considered, to saying that NPR has not been served well by the top management or some members of it. I don't want to, indict, everyone. It just, what I hear from the listeners is, doesn't anyone care at the top about NPR? Which, of course, they do. But, you know, the actions of the last 6 months have as you said, saddened a lot of listeners.
Thanks, Karen.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye-bye. 614-292-8513. We have Alicia Shepherd, the NPR ombudsman, with us for about 10 more minutes. I'll try to get as many calls as I can. We have an email from Jeff in Columbus. He says, I am a devoted listener. I can't believe your guest just said the lesson to be learned is that the mic is always on. Shouldn't the lesson be to better vet NPR's executives so they don't have such extremist views? I like to listen to NPR I like to listen because NPR is center, though obviously leans left, and I lean right. I don't mind as long as it tries to be center.
I think Jeff makes a good point, and I think Ron Schiller was vetted, not well enough. I don't know how to respond to that, but I do think that there is something that's happening in our society where everything is public, and I just think people need to be mindful of that. And I teach media ethics at Georgetown University. I speak to college students, and I think it's important to just remind them of that. It's not that people don't, and particularly journalists, don't have thoughts, don't have opinions, don't have biases, but they need to, you know, keep them to themselves and be professional and be, you know, do the job of a journalist, which is to represent all sides.
614-292-8513. Tina from Sunbury, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I think my problem is I'm conservative, but I listen to NPR and PBS, so I can get all sides and make up my own mind about things.
Good for you. Thank you.
But when things like Nina Totenberg coming out saying she wished Jesse Helms got AIDS and his grandchildren got AIDS, and nothing happens, and Juan William comes out and simply says that, you know, he's somewhat uncomfortable with a Muslim man on an airplane, it kind of makes us feel like, okay, double standard here, that you are leaning more left. And so it's harder for us to accept that you're center when things like that happen.
Well, I appreciate that, Tina. What is frustrating is that NPR did such a bad job explaining why Juan Williams was let go and that it wasn't based on one remark. I think we've talked about this before, but there have been a series of remarks that Juan had made that NPR had asked him to please tone down, that the role of the journalist is to not reflect your personal biases public, because then the person who feels that you are against them is not going to feel that they have a fair shake. And I think that makes sense. I mean, if I was covering the political campaign and I was a big John McCain supporter and upfront about it, and then had to cover Barack Obama, he's not going to feel that he could get a fair shake. Mm-hmm. Anyway, that's just standard journalism. But the Nina Totenberg comment was 15 years ago. I'm not sure it was as vicious as Tina just said, but it was offensive. And people bring it up a lot, I think, because it's gotten out there on the Internet, even though it didn't at the time, because there was no Internet. And there just aren't more examples of that. So I don't really think it's a double standard. But I will also throw in that Tina's concerns have been heard by NPR. They hired someone to review their ethics code, and I think that they are going to review further any, you know, future contracts that NPR employees have with other outside media organizations.
How would that compare with what other media organizations do when it comes to ethics?
I would say that NPR was ahead of the game on that, because as someone who teaches media ethics and is looking at other organizations' ethics codes all the time, they need to be updated and reviewed, you know, every few years, and that doesn't happen. I mean, some of them are 2006, 1999, plus there's this whole social media element that there need to be guidelines on that. And I asked my students, see if you can find an ethics code that has a social media element to it, and very hard to find. And this is a concern because, as I said, that Jeff didn't like, you know, we do live in public, and anyone who works for a news organization in their news department represents them, and they need to be careful on Facebook, on Twitter, wherever they're texting, whatever they're doing, because things are all in public now.
Jay from Columbus, welcome to the show.
Hello, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Good morning.
Yeah, hi. I am Christian. I'm conservative, and I'm Republican. But I want you to know that I have a very deep, heartfelt appreciation for NPR, and I listen a lot. And likely the leadership crisis, if you want to call it that, with NPR seems to also exist in each of the sectors I represent. Mm-hmm. You know, Republicans, I think a lot of times they get arrogant, and conservatives and so forth, they seem to, and I don't want to get political here, but they seem to get off on their own agendas and forget to listen to those who differ with them. And I think that's what's happening in Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm.
It's happening here in Ohio.
And it's happening here in Washington, I think.
Yeah, I just wish they would get off their high horses and, you know, go to the union halls and listen to the common person and not do their agenda on the backs of public servants. I mean, and that's kind of what's going on in Wisconsin and Ohio and Washington. But I appreciate the lessons we're learning from NPR as we're listening now, and thank you.
Thank you, Jen.
Wow. I mean, I think that's a really instructive phone call, Christian, conservative, Republican. I think that it was said on the Diane Reams show yesterday, and I would probably be best double-checking it, but that more conservatives listen to public radio than listen to Fox News. And that's because public radio reaches 34 million people, and Fox News, a Bill O'Reilly show, isn't going to get near those numbers.
That is pretty amazing. We're not going to have enough time to take the rest of the calls. I want to thank all of the folks who have called. I want to thank my guest, Alicia Shepard, NPR Ombudsman. Thanks for joining us again, Alicia. Once again, I'll say, I hope you can join us again before you leave your post.
Okay. Let me please encourage any listeners, contact me by email, which is ashepard, S-H-E-P-A-R-D, at npr.org if they didn't get a chance to get on the air. Everyone at NPR's first initial, last name, at npr.org.
Okay. And we'll post that email address on our website at wosu.org/allsides. Thanks again, Alicia.
Yes, and thank you for the job you do.
You're welcome. We'll be right back. We're going to talk with the subject of and the filmmaker of a new documentary out that's going to be in Columbus this coming weekend for just one showing. So stay tuned. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.
The Danish film In a Better World won this year's Oscar and Golden Globe for Best Foreign Film. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with the director, Susanna Beer, about why she's interested in stories of war and revenge, and about why she signed the Dogma Manifesto before making one of her films. Join us.
And Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes. It starts at noon on 89.7 NPR News. Join WOSU-TV tonight at 8 and celebrate North America's steam railways. This documentary explores the impact of the steam engine by visiting historic railways from Alaska to Arizona to New Hampshire. Watch Celebrating North America's Steam Railways tonight at 8 on WOSU-TV.
Support for 89.7 comes from the McCoy Center. NASA engineer Kobe Boykins will engage an all-ages audience about his work with space exploration and the Mars Science Laboratory Friday, March 18th at the McCoy Center in New Albany. Details at mccoycenter.org.
This is 89.7 NPR News. 39 degrees in downtown Columbus at 11:40 this morning. Occasional rain showers today and temperatures falling throughout the day. Expect a rain-snow mix this evening and then becoming all snow overnight, 1 to 2 inches of accumulation possible, and a low of 28 degrees. There's a chance of rain and snow for Friday morning, and then some sunshine for Friday, a high of 42. A slight chance of snow Friday night, a low of 32 degrees. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News.
The whole whole thing started off when Frank came in, Cafe Gratitude, a mostly raw food restaurant, and we have a question of the day. And the question of the day was, what do you want to do before you die? And Frank said, I want to fall in love one more time. I don't think anyone will love me with this body that I'm wearing because I don't love myself.
That's a scene from the movie May I Be Frank, and welcome to All Sides. The May I Be Frank documents the transformation of one man, Frank Ferrante, with the help of three other men over the period of 42 days. At the outset, Frank is 54 years old, obese, depressed, and addicted. With the help of three workers at a local cafe in San Francisco, he started to eat healthful food, which that's the least of it, and also combat the negativity that had clouded almost his entire life. What did it take to turn him around? How does gratitude figure into the equation? And why should the rest of us care? Joining us today is the director of the film, which deals with Frank's struggle, Greg Marks. Welcome to the show, Greg.
Hi. How are you? Thank you so much for having us.
You're welcome. And also Frank Ferrante. Welcome to the show, Frank.
Good morning. And by the way, it says, can I be Frank on the screen? It says, may I be Frank?
Sorry about that. I actually watched the movie, so there you go. Someone's being polite, right? Frank, tell us about that moment when you were approached about changing your life and why it happened in the first place.
Well, it was a point in my life where I had I felt like I was really at the end of my rope. I couldn't. I wasn't suicidal, but I was at a point where if I was told that I had like 5 hours to live, I'd say, well, do we have to wait that long? I was about 300 pounds. I was depressed. I was incredibly lonely, and I couldn't see a way past it. I just couldn't see a way past it. And when I at the moment that I walked into the restaurant and met Rylan and Carrie and Connor, I was ready to for something. I didn't know what it looked like. I didn't know what I was ready for. I just knew I needed to have a shift because I was on the I was on the verge of being assaulted with all the illnesses that happened as a result of obesity. I was pre-diabetic. I was my heart was starting to bother me, and so all that stuff was happening, and so the answer to your question is I really wanted something to change, and I was open to it.
So, but they just picked you out of the crowd?
Well, no, actually, I did not. If they did, it wasn't very hard to pick me out of the crowd. I mean, excuse me, the restaurant, Gratitude Cafe, is a raw food vegan restaurant. And there I was. I lumbered into this place, and most of the people in there are raw food vegans, and in San Francisco. And I am a working class, blue collar, somewhat well read Italian guy from New York, from Brooklyn, that could have been one of the guys in The Sopranos. So I definitely stood out in this place, and I think that they picked me because of that, because I wasn't one of them, so to speak, and I think also I showed a great deal of affection toward them as well.
The movie we're talking about, May I Be Frank, is going to be showing at the Ohio Union on Saturday at noon. We'll have a link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides with more information about that if you're interested in seeing it. My guests right now, Greg Marks, the film director, and also Frank Ferrante, the subject of May I Be Frank. Let's hear from the film right now. It's something of a daily affirmation.
It's nice to meet you. No, I'm not from outer space.
Repeat after me.
Yes, sir.
I, Frank.
Do love me.
Do love me.
I have perfect health.
Radiant beauty.
It feels terrible.
This is what you want.
All right.
Okay.
I keep thinking every day, well, you know, if something will happen today to create a shift, somewhere in me I believe that things are going to change.
What would love do now?
It's just that I don't see how.
What would love do now?
Frank, the daily affirmations, that part of the movie was interesting because they caught you at different places, different times, and kind of edited them together. When did you start believing what you were saying? How long did it take?
It took a while. When I first started doing them, I felt like I was going to be struck by lightning for lying, because I so didn't believe what I was saying. But that's one of those voices I discovered later that is in my head. That, for example, one affirmation is I am worthy of being loved.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't feel that at the time, but when I said it, I realized, so who is that voice in my head that says I'm not worthy of being loved? Who is that voice? I mean, why is that a lie? But it felt like such a lie that I was going to be punished for it. It took a while. It took about 2 weeks before I started, like, okay, you know, just sort of doing it without cringing. And then after a while, it becomes easier. It's like carving a new neural pathway.
Hmm.
Yeah, that's one of the reasons the workbook is 42 days long that he did that with, is that there is actually research that shows that if you do something for 40 days or more and you repeatedly do it, it will actually make a new neural pathway in your brain and a new way of being.
Like that brain plasticity.
Yeah, it actually, you start to change that old autopilot response you used to have. And now you have a new autopilot response, which is, I love myself, I am worthy of love. And you actually believe it.
Greg, you knew once you heard of the story of the three men trying to help Frank that you wanted to be a part of helping to direct the documentary. What was it that stood out to you? What attracted you to this topic?
I think it was the same thing that the guys were when they were attracted to Frank. There is something about him that, even though instantly, I think, you know, there's a lot of bravado there, you can see and feel his heart. And, the universe threw me together with these guys just like they did Frank. I was from New York City, and I came out to San Francisco wanting to make meaningful films. And within a week, they were the first guys I met. I saw the footage, the raw footage, and I literally stayed up all night watching it because I could not stop. It was compelling. I cried, and I laughed, and I was moved. And I just knew in my heart that this was a story of an everyday man that was so magical, and it needed to be told, because we each have that in all of us. And if the everyday person saw this film about an everyday guy who transforms his life, it might inspire them to take it on. You know, let's just put it this way. I felt I didn't have a choice. Once I saw the footage, my heart drove me to help make this film.
Frank, how did you keep from stilting yourself, from changing who you were really, who you are inside, because you were being filmed? There was not a fly on the wall. It was a camera in your face. That coming from a journalist.
Well, in the first place, I had no idea of what we were doing, and neither did anybody else. I had no idea that this was going to be the final product. We didn't have a narrative. It was just point and shoot. And keep in mind, with today's technology, the camera was the size of a half a carton of cigarettes. It wasn't like this huge TV thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so, we made a boom mic out of PVC pipe. So it wasn't like it had the gravitas of a studio set. And so, in a very, very short time, the camera really disappeared. It just became part of the background. And also, there was interaction between the filmmakers and myself at the time. But again, you know, we really didn't know we were making a film, and we certainly didn't know we were going to be filming about transformation. We originally, the guys just thought, you know, and they were very young at the time. They were in their 20s.
Mm-hmm.
They just thought they'd make something that was really cool to show their parents at Christmas time. You know, like, they had no idea that this is going to, you know, that this is going to be the way it was, that it would escalate to this. But at the time, you know, it was as if the camera wasn't there. And the other thing was, I was so lonely at the time that just anybody being around was welcome. And so.
There was a lot of moving parts to the film, but I guess, Greg, first I want to know, when did you jump into the process of the filmmaking? Well, was all the raw footage done?
Well, yeah, basically when I met the guys, they had bought a camera and they literally turned it on and off every day during the 42-day period when he went through all this. And I have to say they did a really great job. And what happened was is that they didn't know what to do with it. So they literally put the tapes in a box on a shelf and sort of put this affirmation out to the universe, hey, we need a filmmaker to show up and make this movie. And when I came and met them and I saw the footage, of course I was blown away and instantly wanted to do it. But I saw that there was also some elements that needed to be told. So I think the first 6 months I spent flying around the country and interviewing Frank's family members and doctors and just filling in the blanks. And then I, you know, after about 6 months of doing that, another 60 hours of footage, I sat down and started to edit it.
It was amazing, considering it was amateurly done. Some of the colors really came into play for me when Frank was really feeling crushed in that room, the purple room.
Yeah.
It could almost have been planned that way.
Yeah, and that's the amazing thing about this is that they were truly just following their intuition because they had no experience whatsoever. And that's what, and I think one of the most powerful things about the film, and even when I shot my extra footage, I tried to mimic the style that they started with because you feel like you're in the room with Frank the whole time. And I think there's a power to that. Like, there's a certain point in the movie where people tell us, I didn't think I was watching a documentary. I actually thought I was in the story with him, taking this ride with him. And I think it's actually an asset to the film that some filmmakers would find as a deficit, but I think it's an asset to this one.
Frank, when this all started for you, was it kind of like a glorified diet? And did you know what was going to happen, or did you hope what would happen?
Well, actually, if I knew what was going to happen, I might not have participated.
Mm-hmm.
In the
film. Yeah, yeah.
For starters,
because it was a struggle. It was tough.
You know, I mean, well, first of all, I didn't think I was going to get. I didn't think there was going to be that much introspection and excavation involved. I mean, that was a spiritual and excavation for me,
mm-hmm.
And it needed to happen, but. And I guess I also wanted it to happen because none of us are victims. And so, but when I started out, you know, I thought, okay, well, I'm going to hang around with these really cool, you know, these really adorable hippies in San Francisco. Aren't they sweet? You know,
mm-hmm.
and I'm going to eat, you know, nuclear-powered rabbit food. And as I said in the film, like eat some nuclear-powered rabbit food and lose some weight. And instead, what happened was that as I entered into this lifestyle, which I knew nothing about, I thought vegan was a planet. I didn't know anything about this stuff. And so as I entered into this and started living clean and eating clean and vibing clean, the mechanism that was in place to hold the illusion together, to hold the game face intact, started to dissolve. And what began to emerge was who I was, and the first thing about who I was the enormous amount of pain that I was in.
There's a spot. Well, first of all, you talked about the three men, Ryland, Connor, and Carrie, who initially made your whole transformation possible. And within this clip, we're going to hear you describe the way in which they complemented each other and worked together to help you help yourself.
You need oregano, and you need lettuce, and you need tomatoes to make a salad, you know, and every ingredient is integral to that salad. And, you know, put them all together, and it's wonderful. Individually, they're all good, too. And, you know, but that's what it's like. They're like a salad, you know, like, you know, it's like, you know, I can separate them. But in the end, you know, they're from one bowl of lunacy.
So when you listen back to that, Frank, how often have you watched the film? And when you listen back to yourself like that, how does it make you feel?
Well, I have to confess, I haven't watched the film in a very, very long time. The first time I saw the film, it was uncut. It was about 2 hours long. And I was literally in the fetal position for about 2 weeks. It was incredibly difficult to watch. Today, I mean, I haven't watched it in a long time. But when I, you know, there are certain parts that I come in at the end, and I love the part with my. Well, I don't want to give too much away, but there are parts that I do love,
mm-hmm.
and there are parts that are hard to watch because they reflect a part of me that I guess I still need to address. But it's a very raw film. It's at least as raw as the food is. and so it's really. I mean, imagine what it's like. I'm sure that you have a picture. I mean, I'm sure you have a picture at home that makes you cringe, right? And like, but you keep it because it has sentimental value. Somebody, your child is in it, or somebody that you care about is in there. So you keep this picture, but it makes you cringe.
Mm-hmm.
Well, imagine looking at a picture that makes you cringe in Technicolor with a soundtrack, and it's 90 minutes long. That's my experience watching the film.
There were, I guess, a lot of great parts in it. My two favorite parts. One was when you became more understanding about the pain and the spasms in your back.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was in the Purple Room or the Violet Room. And
right.
That was a big, big turning point for me in the film. Can you tell us about it?
Well, that the scene you're talking about I was getting a massage therapy. It was deep tissue.
Oh, that's right.
Massage. And again, I entered this with a great degree of cynicism. I didn't believe in cellular memory, and you know, I didn't believe in stuff I didn't want to deal with. Is essentially it. You know, my ignorance was definitely embraced.
Mm-hmm.
I embraced my ignorance, and it was taken away from me. Through this film, but when I was a kid, I used to fight with my brother all the time, and there was one time I was really vicious and mean, and I went after him, and he ran away from me, and I threw a punch at him, and I caught with everything I had, and I hit his back as he was running away from me, and later on, I would always get these spasms between my shoulder blades for no apparent reason. That were like when I was doing carpentry, I'd have to stop working because it hurt so bad, and I never associated those two things. I never associated that because I always felt bad about it, but I buried it. And during this session, it came out, and also because I wasn't medicating, and I wasn't eating, and I wasn't doing all those things that I was doing to maintain that distance from that experience.
Mm-hmm.
And when that happened, it was as if somebody put a stick of dynamite in the dam and just the waters just began to flow where they were supposed to flow in the first place. And it was an enormous release. And I have to say that I never had those spasms ever again. And it's still this is why I don't watch the film. You know, it still gets to me.
Well, I want to thank you for joining us. We could talk about it a lot more, and I appreciate the time you've given us today. Greg Marks, director of May I Be Frank. Thanks for joining us, Greg.
Thank you so much.
And also, Frank Ferrante, the subject of May I Be Frank. Frank, you're going to be in town this weekend to talk with folks who come to see the movie?
Yes, ma'am, and we really look forward to it. I've never been to Columbus, so I'm looking forward to it.
Well, welcome to Columbus. That will be showing at noon at the Ohio Union. Go to WOSU.org/allsides and hear more. This is All Sides. This is WOSU 89.7, WOSU HD1, and WOSU 820 Columbus, and streaming online at WOSU.org. 89.7 NPR News, a service of WOSU Public Media.